Hey, Deserving listeners, as a lot of you know, there's a lot of talk online and in our culture about psychedelic therapy. And as a way of clearing up some of the myths and clarifying what we know about the form of therapy, I thought I'd have an expert come on the podcast, Dr. Elizabeth Nielsen, who's a psychologist. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
You've come on the podcast before, it was a few years ago. And we recently reran that episode, and I was listening back to it, and I thought, wow, what a great episode. I mean, there was so much information that you provided, and I was wondering, as I was listening, what the current landscape is, if there's any updates. So let's start from the beginning. What is psychedelic therapy exactly?
Well, that's a great question. It's a great place to start because I think it's a place where different people might have different answers. So for me, when I think about psychedelic therapy, I think about the combination of the use of a psychedelic in the context of therapy or in the context of psychotherapy. And so implied in there is a certain set of intentions, right, to heal some sort of mental distress, some sort of, you could say, mental health problem, if that's really the paradigm or the way that you frame things. But there's this therapeutic intention, which is different from other sets of intentions that people may have when they use psychedelics. And that really frames it, part of what frames it as a therapy. So you might be looking at something like, for instance, psilocybin therapy for depression or MDMA assisted therapy for post-traumatic stress disorder. And in those, there's always, you know, the indication or the reason that someone is taking it. And then it's embedded in this therapeutic framework, right? So you're working with dynamics of the mind, you're working with psychological factors, you're working with the subjective experience of the psychedelic in that context to help someone move towards change. So it's not entirely reliant on just the pharmacological effects. I would say it's a blend or a continuum between subjective effects and pharmacological effects, where with, you know, most of the drug treatments that people are familiar with, for instance, if you're taking a traditional antidepressant or something, you're really looking to that based on the pharmacological effects, what it does to in the brain and the neurotransmitters, right? And less of a focus on what the intense, acute, subjective effects are.
Right, exactly. So when someone is prescribed Xanax or a benzodiazepine for acute anxiety, the protocol doesn't necessarily and doesn't usually include any kind of psychotherapy component. The person reports having a spike in anxiety. They are instructed by their prescriber to take a certain dose of the benzodiazepine, like Valium or Xanax, and they take the medication. They benefit, hopefully or potentially, from the effects. They move on with their day. They might report to a psychotherapist later or something like that, but it's not integral in the protocol. Whereas with psychedelic therapy, at least in its current state, there are, correct me if I'm wrong, usually two psychotherapists right next to the individual for a number of hours as they are administered the psychedelic and feel the effects over a span of time. And there are a number of sessions with this individual and the two experts to work on a particular diagnosis like PTSD, that kind of thing. Is that right?
Right. And, you know, I think it's important to say we're speaking in really broad generalizations right now. So yes, what you've said about most protocols is true. The protocols that we're talking about in terms of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy or psilocybin-assisted treatment for depression, those things are still being researched right now. They're not approved treatments for any indication by the FDA. So I've worked in research for a long time. I've helped write research protocols and teach research clinicians and all kinds of things like that. So I'm very familiar with what goes on in those research settings enough to be able to say, you know, here's how it's generally conducted in these research settings. But it's important for people to know that as of today and probably for at least a few months to come, none of these are approved treatments by the FDA. So we are still very much in this research phase. And yes, you know, I think another thing that sets these types of therapies apart and this approach apart is that we're looking at enduring effects long past the active stage in which the drug is in effect in the body, right? So if you, like the example you gave, if you take a Xanax for your anxiety, it's going to treat that anxiety as long as until the Xanax wears off. And then your anxiety is going to come back. And there isn't really a sense of using that state in a way to make some transformational process occur that is going to alleviate you of the roots of that anxiety going forward from there. It's just not the approach. And with psychedelics, we generally are talking about finding ways to build from that single intense experience or a few intense experiences into lasting change that is enduring long past when the psychedelic is active in the body. And we've seen several interesting follow-up studies where people who took psilocybin for anxiety related to cancer, for instance, demonstrated enduring effects, enduring improvements long after their treatment.
Because a lot of people anecdotally will say that that will happen not only with the protocol, but also just recreationally. They will take mushrooms when they were 22 and it will completely change their perspective. And they only took mushrooms once and then they were forever changed. Yeah, again, this is anecdote, of course, and there are, of course, risks, but anyway, so to contrast what you're saying, just so people understand, that right now the state of affairs is that it's still in the research phase. And when it comes to medications, psychotropics, it's common, if not always recommended and universal, that there's a lot of data that needs to be gathered before it can be recommended. And before we know what it's doing, before we even know it's effective and know all the risks, and given current funding, even in a robustly funded situation, it could take years, decades before it is approved for public use, you know, where, for example, a physician, you know, that you have, your psychiatrist or your psychologist or your therapist or your doctor could prescribe such a protocol of psychedelic therapy to you. We're still in that data gathering phase. So that's normal. It's complicated by the fact that there's all this culture and legal red tape, which I want to get into as well. The other thing I want to contrast that you were saying earlier so that people understand is that when we're talking about psychedelic therapy, correct me if I'm wrong, we're not talking about just taking it on your own. Right? Because people will say it, they'll be like, I'm doing my own microdosing psychedelic therapy. And officially, that's not what you are talking about. That's not what the researchers and the clinicians are talking about when they're talking about psychedelic therapy. Also, you said that the psychedelic therapy is used to treat particular disorders, which I want to ask you, what is the set of disorders? But also, it's not just for self-actualization. It's not just for self-discovery yet. Maybe one day that will be studied, but currently it's limited to those disorders and symptom reduction regarding that.
You know, one of the projects that I was working on when we spoke last was a trial of MDMA assisted therapy for post-traumatic stress disorder. It was a trial sponsored by MAPS. I worked on several of their trials over the course of 5 or 6 years. So it was really a long-term project. And, you know, I can say that wrapped up, the phase 3 trial wrapped up late last year, and they put out a press release a couple of weeks ago, actually, stating that, you know, they had results from phase 3 trial, and those results are statistically significant, I believe. And so folks can look that up. But what that means is that trajectory of research of MDMA is actually has completed phase 3 trials and is now in the process of, you know, MAPS is in the process of applying to the FDA for approval to use MDMA-assisted therapy, to bring MDMA-assisted therapy to people through the medical healthcare system. There's still a bit of things that need to happen there in terms of approvals and reviews and all of that. But that's, you know, the timeline on that, I think, is not actually that far away. It was when we last spoke, but, you know, we're probably looking at a matter of, a year to two or somewhere around there. Now, I'm not, you know, saying anything on behalf of the company. I don't have any inside information there, but, they have predictions, and they sort of adjust those as they go along, and they find out more about what's going to be needed from the process. But those phase 3 trials have run. Which is great, and that's the only it's the only psychedelic assisted therapy trial set of trials that has gotten that far. Others, yes, I do think it is going to be several, you know, in the order of several years to a decade before we start seeing a lot more of that. And the other thing I wanted to say is, you know, we do have plenty of data from survey research and population data research that people can take psychedelics on their own in other non-clinical settings. Any other setting besides with a doctor, we would say is a non-clinical setting, and have some positive benefit from that. And we know that it happens. There are also risks. It's not risk-free, either in a clinical setting or in a non-clinical setting. But I think what's important to know about the science is it's kind of following what people are doing and reporting. So often you see this trend of anecdotal research, you know, self-reports, case reports, et cetera, and then scientists coming in and saying, well, can we verify that? Can we do that with more people? Can we demonstrate for whom it really works and to what extent and by how many percentage points? And then we develop treatments out of that. And I think there's a natural, sort of a natural evolution there that's going on. But yes, when I talk about psychedelic assisted therapy, I'm talking about it for a specific indication. That's kind of what makes it therapy as opposed to use for spiritual reasons or self-explorations. I do want to put a bookmark in something for later, which is that the program has been approved in Oregon, which is Measure 109, and approves the use of psilocybin in a supervised adult use setting. Is not a therapy approach. It's not psilocybin assisted therapy. It's supervised adult use, but it does allow for people to use psilocybin under supervision for whatever motivation they have. So we can come back to that later because it's a little outside of the therapy topic, but it's important for people to know that distinction.
Because people might confuse the two. It could look similar. People could claim not only as a client that it transformed them or cured their PTSD or something, mm-hmm. but it could be a breeding ground for charlatans to come forward and say, we're at the cutting edge providing psychedelic therapy when officially, well, what is the legality around that? Because could you claim, because there's aromatherapy, you have like color therapy, like is the word psychedelic therapy a legal term that can only be used by people that are doing what you're talking about?
Yeah, so the state of Oregon approved Measure 109. It was a voter-approved ballot initiative, and that actually passed, and I think it was the fall of 2020. And then it took 2 years to set up regulations, and businesses, you know, are getting just beginning to get licensed under those regulations now in early 2023. And I'm involved because I developed and run an approved and licensed training program there for psilocybin facilitators. So the good thing about it is that it's regulated such that facilitators and businesses can't make claims that they're offering therapy or they're offering treatment because it's not a treatment model. And there are avenues of recourse, right? People have to, in order to be providing this service, have to do training with an approved program. They have to get licensed. They have to follow certain regulations and you know, ethical guidelines or ethical mandates that they have. And so there is a structure around it, which I think, you know, also is structured in terms of making sure that people have a safe supply of psilocybin products that are going to be used in these settings, that people are taking them in supervised settings. So while someone could make a claim like that, now there's actually a regulatory framework and process where there is a protected scope of practice with this in Oregon.
So a licensing or a registration process?
Licensing. Mm-hmm. It's a state licensing process, yep.
In Oregon. And how would people find those services?
So right now, the state just started accepting licenses for service centers, which are the kinds of places where all psilocybin services must take place. And I don't believe we have any service centers actually approved yet. I know I checked the stats a week ago, and they had just begun to see a few applications come in. I expect it's going to be around 6 months before we start to see a handful of service centers open. facilitators who are going to be the people who will see individuals through this process, providing informed consent, preparation, session facilitation, and then integration work. Those individuals are, many of them are in training right now in our program and other programs. And I expect we'll start to see some graduations and people getting those licenses again around the middle of the year, at which point you'll start to see actual licensed offerings of psilocybin services with licensed facilitators.
So just so people know, because sometimes people listen at various different times, we're in late February of 2023 as of now of the recording. So let me get this straight. So in Oregon, presumably within 6 months to a year, there will be these service centers that people can sign up for. It'll be a similar protocol to the one that you researched, where there are two facilitators as the individual takes psilocybin?
It won't require two facilitators. It will only require one licensed facilitator to be there, although there may be other staff present to assist. Again, it's not therapy, so it's not following exactly the same therapeutic procedures that I've seen in many research protocols, again, speaking very broadly. But it is following, I think, some of the same basic, I would say some of the same basic principles of safety and caring for somebody while they're in this intensive, non-ordinary state of consciousness. I think it carries some of the best practices that we've seen put into place in research studies. I know there's been conversation there between researchers and people who created the regulations for how this is to be administered. But because it is not healthcare, and in Oregon, the Measure 109 is not a healthcare provision, it's not a healthcare service, it's not the healthcare system, it's an entirely separate scope of practice, separate license. And it's not considered treatment for any particular diagnosis, there's no weaving in of anything that would address a particular symptom or a particular, you know, a particular health problem, if you will.
And the facilitators presumably have been trained and hopefully will practice the practice that will head it off of the pass. For example, if a client, someone comes in, a customer comes in and says, you know, starts to take the psilocybin and says like, oh, well, I want to try to cure my PTSD or I'm trying to work on my depression. The facilitator knows to say, oh, by the way, this is not what we're doing here. What we're doing. Well, what would they say that what they're doing exactly?
You know, I think it's a little bit of a, I think it's a little bit unknown, right? Because this is a new scope of practice and there is no precedent established. But you know, I run a training program and I would say the training is very extensive. And I think what the intention is for facilitators to be able to say, you know, you can come to this with any intention and you can explore whatever it is that you want to explore and you can work to apply it to whatever you want to apply it to, but it can't be offered as a treatment for that thing. So I can't promise you, if you do this, you have a X percentage point chance of reducing your symptoms in some specific way. Mm-hmm. However, it might be helpful. Everybody acknowledges that it might be helpful, and it has to really be on an individual basis.
And these facilitators are clinicians, licensed clinicians?
They don't have to be.
Okay.
They are getting licensed as facilitators, which is a new scope of practice. And in order to be a licensed facilitator, you are not required to already be a mental health care provider. There are a variety of programs that are offering this training. The program that I offer, that I'm the director for at Fluence, is a program that is focused on training mental health care providers or people with experience providing psychotherapy already. It's just the lens that we happen to be coming from. But there are programs that accept people who do not have that background.
So someone could have no education in mental health and be a facilitator. And someone could be a psychologist and have a tremendous amount of experience treating all sorts of things that are currently being looked at in terms of psychedelic therapy.
Yep.
That's interesting. You know, there's a lot of unknowns in terms of how to provide some guardrails for the treatment? Because I could really see a scenario where, I'll just take me for example, if I was trained to do this and I had a customer who was talking about, you know, they could talk about whatever they want to talk about when they're going through this, right? And correct me if I'm wrong, but they are administered the dose and they are in the facility for a few hours, right?
Yep.
Yeah. And so I'd be with this individual the entire time or off and on. Or the entire
time? You would be with them the entire time, yeah.
You could have a customer that is there for whatever reason they want to be there, as is explicitly stated, and they're there to work on their PTSD. They were traumatized as a child, and they have some awareness of that. And so they start to talk about that. They start to talk about their feelings. They talk about the experiences. They talk about meanings. As a trained professional who helps people with that, I can't turn off my focus or what I would see. Presumably I'd have the training and the guardrails in terms of what I can say, but there'd be nothing stopping me from saying, how did that make you feel? Or tell me more, what's going on there? Or if they asked me in the middle of this, like, does that sound like trauma to you? And am I supposed to say clinically, I can't answer that question because we're not in a therapy? Like, where are the guardrails exactly?
Well, again, a lot of these questions are really along the lines of like what is going to be established as far as best practices and what is going to be established in terms of the, you know, the way that this actually plays out and standard of care. And we don't have that yet because we don't have this care being provided yet. But I will say that the regulations prohibit facilitators from engaging in another practice, another licensed practice while they're acting as facilitators. So what they do give you is and what we train people in is, the methodology of providing a non-directive supportive stance and presence during those sessions and what you can do during those sessions. And I think that especially during the intense psilocybin session, that approach is actually akin to a lot of what I've seen in research protocols. It's not really the time to be trying to engage someone in psychotherapy. So of course you're going to listen and you're going to respond appropriately, but it wouldn't really be even in a research setting a time that you would be necessarily diving into intensive psychotherapy. I know there are exceptions, of course, to everything. So some of your listeners are probably thinking, oh, but I know this protocol where they actually do that in the middle of the session. Yes, it happens. But by and large, I think that there is a trend towards a non-directive supportive stance. And I've seen that in studies that I've worked on, and I've seen it in other protocols.
Interesting. So you're saying that even the protocols that are being tested for PTSD, for example, which in psychotherapy without psychedelics tends to often have a pretty rigid methodology, you're saying that those protocols are fairly client-centered and client-directed and not therapist-directed?
Yes. Yes. And the PTSD protocol, and again, this is, you know, coming from the MAPS research, is a little bit different because MDMA is a bit different than working with psilocybin. It tends to be a more interactive experience for folks than I think psilocybin experiences tend to be. And so there is a lot more about in that approach about how to be engaging with someone and really engaging them in actual trauma work during those MDMA sessions. But I think that is actually an artifact of the differences in the subjective effects of MDMA versus psilocybin.
Right. Yeah. Well, let's take a break quickly. And when we get back, we'll continue. So tell me, because I'm curious, and the listeners, what does this look like exactly? Like, what is happening in the session? Because I know better than to think this, but I think a lot of people would think like, oh, it's like the 60s, right? There's like psychedelic music playing and incense and, you know, I don't know, just all the associations that people have with these kinds of drugs, or there's glow sticks and EDM music playing. What does it look like? Ground it in reality for us.
It's a great question. I think, you know, in research settings, psychedelic therapy sessions tend to look a lot like extended therapy sessions with someone lying on the couch. You have to remember that people are coming into those studies usually with a pretty severe amount of stress. And they've been there in that, you know, with those therapists in that room, focusing on whatever it is that is really, you know, really difficult for them, whatever their PTSD or their depression is. So the scene is kind of not set up for it necessarily to be a fun day. As some people might imagine, taking psychedelics is sometimes those experiences are quite challenging. But it is not that they can't also be blissful or fun as well. But it is different when you're coming in with this therapeutic intention and you really are struggling with something. I think, you know, your question has a lot to do with set and setting and expectation and intention. Why are people there? What are they coming in for? What are they hoping to explore? If someone's in a lot of distress and they're coming to you for help, then they may have a very different experience than someone who is not in a lot of distress and is just curious and wants to check this out. Now, under the regulations in Oregon, you can have any intention you want. I mean, you don't have to be there for treatment, obviously, because it's not treatment. It's not offered as treatment. I think that in terms of the actual setting, how it's going to look, we will wind up with a variety, because I know that there are several people trying to go through the process of opening service centers. And again, these are physical spaces where the psilocybin sessions can take place, where psilocybin will be administered directly to the clients who are taking it. It's not a dispensary model. It's really important for you to understand there's no provision for take homes. There's no provision for getting your own and taking it with you in the model in Oregon. It's only on-site administration. And, you know, because there's variety there, and I should say, I'm not intending to open a service center at this point. I'm only running a training program, which is quite an intensive experience. And it's been wonderful, very, very successful. It's 160 hours worth of training, to, you know, give you an idea. We do quite a lot. So, but people, you know, I think with the variety of service centers opening, there's going to be variety, right? There will be some that look more like spas. There may be some that look more playful, maybe some that have more of a nature focus, maybe some that, you know, look a little more like more homey or more clinical. The decor and the setting in terms of what you have there is pretty flexible. And you know, I think if folks are really interested and they want to check out like what the regulations say and what the requirements are, this is all published on Oregon's website. It's just oregon.gov/psilocybin, and you can go on and look at Oregon Health Services, Oregon Psilocybin Services, and all the regulations that have been published there. So it's really nice to be educated. So I'll just put that out there for people that want to do that deep dive.
That's interesting. I just assumed, I think falsely, that the future of this would look like, or you would predict, that it would look similar to the protocol that's being researched, where it's a therapy office or what looks to be like a therapy office, a clinical office. It's comfortable, you know, and there's a couch where someone's laying down and you have your facilitator sitting next to that person for, what are we talking, like 3 to 5 hours-ish? Is that the typical time span?
It's going to depend a little bit on the dose that people have. And people also seem to metabolize psilocybin at slightly different rates. So same dose, different people might take, one might take a bit longer than another, but people will need to stay. It's another thing. They'll need to stay on site until they're able to leave, until they, you know, the acute effects have worn off to the extent that they're able to safely leave.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's the risk there? Driving, that sort of thing?
Absolutely. Don't want people driving immediately after, you know, an experience like this. There's actually a transportation plan that needs to be completed. So people are, you know, have a plan for how they're going to be transported or get transportation home without driving after their sessions. If it's somebody coming to pick them up, or they're going to be taking, you know, an Uber or whatever it is there that they've got, in that particular vicinity, that all needs to be in place at a time.
Is there care on ramping up of dose? Because you will hear from people that they will take psilocybin or LSD or something and have acute effects for many, many hours, and well beyond the hours that the facility is open, I'm guessing, potentially, if you take too much. So is there...
Doses are regulated. Yeah, doses are regulated, and they're not out of the range of what has been given in recent research studies. Another really important point, and I mentioned this before, but I kind of went pretty quickly, is that this regulation provides for safe supply, which means a supply that is tested for purity, tested for concentrations of psilocybin and psilocin. And so people will know actually how much they're getting. And I think one of the issues with, with taking psilocybin outside of a regulated setting has been that, there can be a lot of variation in the actual concentration of psilocybin and psilocin in all variety of mushrooms. I mean, there are many different varieties of mushrooms that contain psilocybin and psilocin. And so you may, have the same purchase the same batch and just happen to have one that is more intense than another. One piece of mushroom is more intense than another and wind up with a lot more than you anticipated. So that this will give us some control in terms of the products actually being regulated and tested, and people will know how much they're getting. And it's also limited in terms of the dose to, within the range of what we have been able to give in research studies.
Meaning that it has been shown that this particular dose is not likely to induce acute effects that would last well beyond the recommended protocol period of time. But it's interesting to think about when you bring up nature and this sort of thing, that in spa-like facilities.
Yeah, I'm confident there will be some places opening that will have more of a boutique upscale experience on offer. And, that those will be really attractive for some people. There's also, quite a possibility that we'll see people traveling from out of state in order to access this kind of service.
Oh, I'm sure of that. I am positive of that. I mean, Seattle was one of the first places to legalize marijuana, and we would see huge influxes of people. A real common scenario would be the cruise ships would stop in Seattle just normally anyway, but you would get this just hundreds, thousands of people just pouring into the weed shops downtown. And then, of course, they're like, let's go for it. And they take an edible that's way too much for them. And so you have like all these, 50s, 60s, 70s year old individuals just completely tripping downtown and going to the ER because they took too much cannabis. And so, yeah, I'm guessing that I guess the benefit is that this regulation in Oregon will prevent that from happening, obviously.
Yes.
If I were to do something like this, this is the way I'd want to do it. I'd want to do it under supervision. I'd want to do it under regulated, tested compounds that are being administered to me. I wouldn't want to mess around with that. I don't have a guy that I can trust with this sort of thing. I would want someone there in case something wonky happens. It would feel good to know that they're not going to abandon me, or they're not going to be tripping themselves, or that cops aren't going to suddenly show up and freak me out, or whatever, that other people have come before me. I could see this becoming gigantic. There are plenty of people doing these kinds of things recreationally, and they have a guy and they trust and they know what they're getting into. But there's a vast sea of people that are curious, or they might have had an experience that they had in the past and they want to recreate that or have more of that. And I could see this being really important for people and transformational. Is that your hope?
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's a set of regulations that it's new. So we haven't really had a chance to try them out yet and see how they fit. At the same time, I think the anticipation is that hopefully this will be successful, that it can be further refined over the course of time, and that it can be something that happens safely enough to be enduring and to be accepted. I certainly, wouldn't want to see that story repeated of people coming off cruise ships and, grabbing a bunch of bags of mushrooms and being, in danger themselves, because there's a lot of risk there. And I think that there's, you know, sentiment of not wanting to, you know, not wanting to set this up in a way where it's going to have negative repercussions, where people are going to be harmed. So it is set up in a pretty cautious way, which does mean that it has some limits, right? For instance, if someone can't get to a service center because they have a health problem, they may not be able to access this right now. And that's, you know, there were definitely a balancing act to be, you know, putting this into place in a way where it could be acceptable. But it's new, it's brand new. And, you know, we can hope that that things do go smoothly. As a facilitator training program, I think that there are some really amazing professionals that are getting involved in this field and who are going to just make it an amazing profession. And a profession that's really only available in this regulated way in a limited set of areas. State of Colorado passed an act that allows for something similar starting in a couple of years. So we'll see if it expands there. A few other states have something, you know, in the kind of cooking on the back burner that might come to fruition. And you know, we have to see, but there's been lessons taken from what happened with cannabis, and there have certainly been lessons taken from, you know, the early wave of psychedelic research and use in the 1960s and 70s to try to create something more positive here that can be enduring.
Yeah, Washington, California, I'm sure will soon follow. What are you hoping for, say, 10 years from now in the landscape of the United States regarding not only these facilities, these non-treatment facilities, but also in terms of the treatments available, FDA approved? What's your vision?
You know, it's interesting. I've always seen the possibility or had the vision for you know, several parallel movements going on, right? So you've got decriminalization, deprioritization, which I think is really, really important because that keeps people from being harmed because they chose to use psychedelics in any other setting or other drugs in places where we've made some advancements in decriminalization. I'm a harm reduction therapist and addiction psychologist by training. Decriminalization, I think, is a really important piece of helping people be able to stay safe and healthy.
And out of prison for silly possession or minor selling arrangements.
Yeah. Prison not being a safe or a healthy place for most people to be. I mean, there's so many reasons why decriminalization is just super important. And that's a whole nother conversation.
Yeah, for people who don't know, in certain jurisdictions, you could be caught with like a small amount of recreational use substance, marijuana, cocaine, MDMA. And if you have a repeat offense of that, you could spend years and years in prison just because you had those substances in your possession. And you're not some hardened criminal that is out there trying to sell it to kindergartners, and you're not a gangbanger shooting people up and all that kind of thing that the conservatives or American culture will sometimes associate with this. You're just a person who has substances and likes to take them, and you do it in a safe way, and you never bother anyone else with it. It's a personal choice you make. And it's just a ridiculous holdover from the war on drugs and Nixon culture, and also based in racism often and classism, because of course it affects people of color, it affects people lower socioeconomic status, underprivileged people, meaning that a rich person can take all the drugs they want and never get caught because of the circumstances around searches and around police behavior and around the legal system. Anyway, so that whole thing, and of course it props up the privatization of prisons, and they have a huge interest in it, and they lobby for it. You know, it's a whole system. I'm not an expert on it. There's all, you know, a lot of experts, a lot of documentaries on this sort of thing, and that whole thing needs to become dismantled. All of us will benefit when we dismantle that nonsense. So that's what you're talking about, right?
That is exactly what I'm talking about. Dismantle that nonsense. And I think, well, I mean, I think the implications of psychedelic therapy actually have a lot to say there, right? Because we're actually asking people to reconsider a drug that has been prohibited and banned and think about it as something that has value in therapeutic use. And that really causes people to go, oh, wait a minute, like what else in this system might we want to question or talk, think differently about? But that is one aspect. And I think it's really important because you know, it also speaks to public acceptance and understanding of, you know, how if psychedelics become, you know, available through the medical system, but they're still stigmatized to the extent that people are, you know, ashamed to be seeking them or using them as part of their therapeutic care. Well, that's not going to help anybody, right?
Because they won't take him. They won't.
Because they won't take them because they're still too stigmatized. They're still going to be shunned by their employers or their families, or they're still going to be, you know, unjustly penalized by the legal system, even though it's not really illegal. You know, there's just a lot of potential there. So those efforts really do, I think, help with public acceptance and people, you know, becoming more open and understanding about the potential benefit and role for psychedelics. Then there's this adult, you know, supervised adult use paradigm, which is what Oregon put into place, where people can take psychedelics for whatever motivation they have, but they can get professional guidance and a safe supply and know that they're, you know, there's recourse if someone hurts them in that setting or does, you know, something unjust to them. It's a licensed professional. There's regulatory bodies in charge of that. And then there's psychedelics through the medical care system, which, you know, for some people where they really are needing it in terms of a treatment for something or seeking it in terms of a treatment for something, that they could be able to go in and have that under the care of their doctor, their therapist, and really use it in that therapeutic way. So, my vision is that all of these things can coexist. I am hopeful for that. I know that there are people who might not see that, but I see these things as mutually, you know, not mutually exclusive, and in fact, sort of filling different needs and different places, and hopefully being able to work synergistically such that they allow each other to be in existence. Right. The model in Oregon is not designed to help people to be treatment or to take this out of the medical care settings, nor would a medical approval fill the need or meet the need that the measure, the current measure and regulations do meet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's take a quick break again, and when we get back, we'll continue. And is your vision that the medical prescription, the psychological service prescription treatment model, is it limited to the current look of the protocol where it is with two facilitators, or will it be a variety of treatment modalities?
I think eventually there will be more variety. The work with two therapists in the treatment setting, you know, initially, I think the thinking in protocol design was, well, let's just throw everything we can in there to make this as, you know, bulletproof safe as possible. And as we learn more and as we get more safety data and as the, you know, researchers begin to, you know, work with different populations and get more practice, I think there is room to start opening things up and start having, you know, for instance, models where you have one facilitator and then somebody else who's kind of on call in the building. Small group work has been done with preparation and integration, especially I'm thinking about a study for people with cancer diagnosis who took psilocybin in a therapeutic protocol. It was published last year, came out of a research center in Maryland, actually. It's called Sunstone. It's a research center there.
And that's supposed to treat the well-being or the anxiety around the diagnosis?
Yeah. Anxiety and, you know, could be anxiety of cancer returning or anxiety, fear of dying or of having these, you know, medical procedures. And so researchers are experimenting with those things. And, you know, the way things are done in research is not always exactly the way they're going to translate to when they get out of the research lab. It's more designed to get the data that's needed to protect safety when especially it's things that haven't been done for a while in a research setting, and you've got a lot of hospital administrators and institutional review boards and the FDA and the DEA all looking at this stuff, and they want to make it as as you know, really, really safe as possible, which is important. But then we learn from that, well, what do we really need? How can we keep people safe? Maybe with, you know, more with the resources distributed in such a way that it could be accessible to more people.
Yeah. As a therapist who has worked with other therapists with clients, I can tell you that it's kind of a mixed bag sometimes, because I'm just imagining myself being a co-facilitator over a number of hours. I would predict that some, and maybe you can attest to this, that some sessions I'd get quite bored, because if I'm not the lead client or the lead interaction person with the client or the person, I start to just get bored. I mean, the client isn't boring to me, but I'm not involved. I'm just watching something happen. And I could just imagine professionally that just wouldn't be very fun. And I would also feel pretty ineffectual, kind of superfluous and useless. It's like, oh, there's probably better use with my time. So, you know, that, did you ever get bored as a co-facilitator?
You know, it's a really great point, because first of all, when you're doing co-facilitation work with in a psychedelic session, you really are working together as a dynamic pair. You're both in relationship with that patient, and you're both caring for them, regardless of whether one of you is sort of silently witnessing what's going on or more actively engaged. But it is a different relationship with the co-therapist, and sometimes your role is actually to support your co-therapist. And, you know, they may be dealing with something really directly that's intense, and your role is supporting them or in some way, or assisting with some other aspect of care. But I think that one concept that's important, and this spans all work, I think, with psychedelics that's done with a therapeutic intention or a healing intention, is your presence, and because of your relationship with the patient and you're having discussed their intention with them and you're having sort of brought this experience into being for them, your relationship with them and your presence with them, even if it is a silent presence and they are deep in their internal process and you're not engaging with them in any observable way, is actually really fundamentally important. Patients will say things to the effect of that they allow themselves to go into internal places that they would not have otherwise allowed themselves to go into and look at things or inspect things or be curious about things, because they knew their therapist, their trusted therapist was sitting right there beside them. And that gave them the support they needed, even though you weren't actively engaged with them at that time. And patients are very sensitive to that often in these experiences. And I think it's an important skill to learn. And it can be a tough thing to really like believe in it, but when it happens a few times and you get that feedback from patients and you realize how aware they are, and sometimes, you know, you may be feeling distracted or, you know, bored or something, and they'll kind of reach out like, are you still there? Because it's a heightened perception and a heightened perception of the relational reality, that relational aspect. And that's extremely important. That relational aspect is extremely important. So there's a lot of value in that.
Yeah. So is getting back to your vision, is part of your vision the prescription only without the psychotherapy component as an option available to clients?
That's a tough question. I'm going to give a little couple of caveats. It depends. For some drugs that are psychedelic, you could say in the family of psychedelics or that are used under this paradigm, let's take ketamine, for example, right? Ketamine right now, for listeners that aren't aware, is a Schedule III drug, and it's available. It's sometimes used off-label as a medication or a prescription for mental health concerns. And it can be used in sort of a psychedelic-assisted therapy paradigm where you're working with a therapist. It can also be used as something that people just take on their own, maybe with a supportive presence of someone or someone on call, but not necessarily engaged in a psychotherapy process. So there's just different ways of working with it. And in that latter scenario, they're really relying on the pharmacological properties, often for the treatment of depression. And we know that there are some people that benefit from that. I certainly wouldn't want them to not be able to have it just because psychotherapy isn't available or appropriate for them, right? I think that with, you know, with psilocybin, MDMA, and some of the drugs that are in development right now, there will be a, you know, when, if and when there is an approval, there will be a paradigm or a, you know, a treatment package that comes with it, which includes some preparation and some, you know, integration, some therapeutic support. And what we have to realize is that that's what's being tested it by and large with these drugs, and not simply, you know, the pharmacological properties on their own. If we even, we don't even, the consensus, or not that we really necessarily have consensus in anything in this field, but the thinking is it wouldn't necessarily even be ethical to do that, to just give somebody with a mental health problem some psilocybin or MDMA and there you go, you know, see what happens without any psychological support, to rely entirely on the pharmacological properties. So that's just not what's happening right now. So if there is, the things that, that are being tested for approval are things that do include that psychological support.
Right. Right. Yeah. Which I think, as you're saying earlier, is a great move to start with the most safest protocol and start looking at other protocols later down the line, not only for the participants, but also for the cultural rollout, if you will. So you're saying that it, your vision or what you predict is that this will never be something like Xanax or like Prozac that will just be prescribed to people without any psychotherapy involved.
That is not what the field is looking at by and large. That would be, I think, a reliance on a pharmacological paradigm, you know, just looking at what the pharmacological effects of the drug are. And really what most of the field is looking at is what is the synergy between the subjective effects that are created by those pharmacological effects, but the subjective effects, and then what are the, what, how do people engage with that? And what do they actually do with it? Mm-hmm. And so that's where the relational and therapeutic support actually come in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're answering it in a very research-oriented way, which is very good. I appreciate that. It models to my listeners how careful researchers and clinicians actually talk. I remember this from our previous episode with you. You know, you're not willy-nilly about your claims or language or predictions, but I will be, because I'm not a researcher in this area, that I could see, and I'm, you know, I know very little compared to you, obviously, but given what I understand to be the psychotropic effects of these compounds, I could imagine a future down the line that these medications could be provided to people similar to other psychotropic medications with oversight, obviously. I have no data on that. I have no expert knowledge on that. But my understanding of these substances is they affect the brain in some particular ways, but some similar ways to other drugs that are being prescribed right now. I mean, there are drugs that affect serotonin and dopamine and, you know, similar neurotransmitters and similar processes in the brain. So, you know, to me, because the way people talk about it, particularly the lay public, it's just like you have your SSRIs and your, you know, other substances that are prescribed, which are those, you know, those clinical drugs. And then you got these wacky psychedelic drugs way over here. But when we're talking about the actual mechanism in the brain, we're talking about things that are all under the same umbrella. It just, for whatever reason, the government decided to, and the culture decided to section off these compounds as like evil and destructive and never therapeutic, never medically helpful.
Well, it wouldn't be because of the physiological safety, but it's more because of how they're being researched as tools for these mental health outcomes. So if you look at things like, again, population data, survey data, people take psychedelics for non-clinical settings for all kinds of reasons. And, you know, by and large, physically are okay, right? We don't see, you know, we don't see certainly the types of physical harm and that sort of thing that we do with some other classes of drugs.
Like alcohol, for example.
Like alcohol, yes. And tobacco and opiates and things like that. So When you the rationale really being that there's this intense subjective experience, and if you want to use that in actual treatment for something, PTSD, depression, et cetera, what's being tested is the use of this intense experience in the therapeutic setting, not just as a take home. Now, somebody might justify doing that research at some point. It'd be interesting to see, but I think that the best possible benefit for these mental health applications is probably going to wind up being with the psychotherapy. And that's really what the, you know, what I think the researchers are onto.
Okay. So I have so many questions, but what I really want to know is, what is it like for these individuals to go through this? What do they experience exactly? You know, say someone for the very first time, they come to you for the protocol. Let's just say they've never taken psilocybin before, MDMA or MDMA. And by the way, the psilocybin, this is synthetic psilocybin, right?
In research studies, it is synthetic.
Because it can come from mushrooms.
In Oregon, yes, it's going to be derived from natural product, yeah.
Oh, in Oregon, it'll be derived, but tested for dosage, that kind of thing.
Tested for purity. So it'll probably look like some dried mushroom products, but it'll be tested for purity and regulated.
Okay. So what's it like? What happens? Because, you know, I could see it. I've seen people go through this. I've watched videos of people going through this. And so I have my own perspective, and I'm guessing the listeners might not know. So what happens to these people?
Well, maybe I could talk through it from the perspective of what it might look like in Oregon, because I think that's it's just a little easier, and it's probably more relevant to, you know, what your listeners might go to Oregon for, or decide to, you know, engage with themselves if that comes to fruition in their jurisdiction as a facilitator. So, you know, facilitators have a role of really being the responsible party. They do a screening questionnaire that's prepared by the state, helps rule out any contraindications. There's an informed consent form, again, it's prepared by Oregon Psilocybin Services, part of Oregon Health Authority.
What would be a contraindication?
Yeah. So, for instance, if someone has, a heart condition, right, they need to be informed, and they should be referred to, you know, to a doctor to have that assessed. Right, if someone is on certain antidepressants, their experience might be blunted. So there's some things that they need to be informed about there. The facilitators, it's important because they are not giving medical advice, and they're not assessing or diagnosing for things, but there are certain things that they need to walk through with the patient as, you know, screening measures, right? It's actually very minimal, but there is this, you know, need for being informed. And again, if your listeners are curious, all of these actual forms, the informed consent, the screening form, it's all posted to the Oregon Psilocybin Services website. So go check them out, because they're informative. They're really nice to know. And then, so a facilitator would, go through an informed consent conversation with someone, make sure they know, you know, what the facilitator's role is going to be, how the facilitator is going to interact with them. The facilitator will discuss permission to touch the client during the session. If the client gives permission for that, they will get it in writing. That could be hand-holding or hand on someone's arm or shoulder to give them some nonverbal support during the session. They'll discuss other safety aspects, the room, the music, what to expect, what to wear, what to eat, you know, those sorts of things, how to prepare. And they'll do a little bit of preparation. Now, the regulations require that facilitators do at least one preparation session and offer at least one integration session after any psilocybin administration. They could do more, but...
So a preparation session that doesn't involve the administration of the substance,
correct,
on a separate day?
Yeah.
Separate day, okay.
Yeah, it would be a separate
the regulation day. Is set up so that... Why? So they make sure that that's all established.
Make sure you get informed consent, that everything is established, that you have a safety plan, that you have a transportation plan, that you have everything, you know, everything really in order, and that people are going to be, you know, safely cared for. And you get that informed consent from people, and then you can proceed with the session, which would take place at a licensed service center. And that's where people would actually receive their dose of psilocybin. And then they would be in a designated session room or space with a facilitator for the duration. And again, the duration could vary a little bit depending on how much psilocybin people have taken. And this is all laid out in the regulations, right? But there's room for variation.
Okay. So then there's a discussion of dosage, maybe based on what they're looking for, what they're comfortable with. So for people out there that know dosage of psilocybin, what's the dosage range we're talking about?
I believe the max dose is 35 milligrams right now of up to 35 milligrams of pure psilocybin. And again, that's regulated in terms of what the, what people like, it's actually measured. So they'll know that that's what they're getting. That is the number cited in the consent form. And as a measure to say, this amount is provided because this is what has been tested, in multiple instances in research studies up to this amount.
So what's a typical amount that people would take recreationally when they're really going for it, so to speak?
Again, there's a lot of variation there, but I think that that is a dose that would be on the, certainly on the upper end or more than many people would take recreationally for recreation.
Oh, really? Okay. So the regulations aren't necessarily playing it safe in that realm. They're allowing for that variability for people.
I believe they're allowing for enough that people will not be limited because they, weren't able to have a large enough dose. I don't think that's the issue.
Interesting. And are the facilitators that you train suggested to not go for it on a high dose with someone that isn't familiar with it and who hasn't done this sort of thing before?
Yeah, I mean, different, there's a lot of different kinds of thinking about this, but I think that once you go over a certain sweet spot, if you will, you're just increasing the likelihood of anxiety and difficulty without really increasing the potential for benefit. So I would encourage people to seek to find a balance, a window to be thinking about things like how much, sort of distress tolerance skill does this individual have, distress coping are they able to engage in, and try to find something that seems like they will be having a noticeable experience and benefiting from it without overshooting the mark. Now, that can be obviously a little bit difficult to tell from the beginning, but many research studies have started with a dose of 25 milligrams and a lot of people have full and sufficient experiences from that. And I think that, increasing from there, it's probably a good idea to have tried that first and seen if more felt tolerable and necessary.
Yeah. And that'd be an individualized conversation with the
facilitators. It's an individualized conversation. Exactly. So if somebody comes in and they have a lot of trepidation and they seem like they really just want to dip a toe in, they could certainly have a lower dose.
Yeah. Like what would be the low end?
For feeling some effects, but at a lower intensity, you might go as low as a milligram. Okay. I'm sorry, 10 milligrams would be, 10 milligrams could be like a starting point, 10, 12, 15, somewhere there. There's no, you don't have to start with the most you think you might be able to take or want.
Right.
I'm a big fan of, start small, start with something. You can always try again and have more.
Yeah. Unless you're getting off a cruise ship and you really want to go for it. Just joking.
Right. This is not a cruise ship model.
So what do people report?
So they start offering it on the cruise ships, in which case that'll be different.
Yes. I'm sure that's in the future. So what do people report as they... Because you worked with dozens, hundreds of people as they went through this in your research. So what did people report to you?
So the research that I worked on, it's funny because most of it was placebo-controlled trials. So some people got placebo. They went through all of this preparation and, setting up for the day and coming in. And then they had a placebo and they had to go through the whole day just as though they had psilocybin, and you don't officially know until maybe at the end of the study when there's a there's a reveal there of who was in the placebo group. But there was also that anticipation. So one thing that we won't have with this is that people, you know, will really be getting psilocybin and psilocybin services. So that I think makes it a little different because it takes some of the anxiety out. And I've seen patients in research studies just be anxious about what's going to happen. Am I going to get anything or nothing, or what's going to happen? So that being said, you know, typically psilocybin, a full dose experience looks something like beginning to feel subjective effects, usually physiological subjective effects, within maybe 25 to 30 minutes, could take as long as an hour. It has to clear your stomach, so it depends on what's in there and how fast you digest, literally, the material that you're eating. You know, oftentimes people have an intensity, increasing intensity until around, let's say, in between 90 minutes and 2 hours, and then sort of a plateau or leveling off, say, until about 3 hours, 3.5 hours, maybe four. And then those effects tend to wane over the next several hours. Sometimes a feeling of them kind of coming back in waves, but slowly dissipating over the course of the next several hours. There's variation, you know, for some people that initial hour can feel really intense. We do know that there's a predictable increase in heart rate and blood pressure. It's modest, but it's noticeable, and it can feel physiologically intense for people. Just a physical activation. There can be odd sensations in the body, noticing sensations that they hadn't noticed before in the stomach, in the chest, in the legs, or, you know, sort of a movement. People feel as though energy is moving in their body, their blood is moving, their breath is moving, and just kind of becoming, developing a heightened sense of awareness. And that can be, I think that can be disorienting for folks. And that's one of the times in which having a, a therapist or a facilitator or somebody who has witnessed this before and knows how to remain calm and provide reassurance and talk someone through that experience, as opposed to perhaps responding in a way that could increase anxiety, is really, really important.
Right. Yeah. Like, say things like, it's normal to have an increase in heartbeat. There's nothing to be afraid of. Mm-hmm. Just that suggestion can cause someone to go down a road of non-anxiety, as opposed to being alone or at a rock concert and you're just, and someone goes, oh my God, are you having a heart attack? And then boom, the person.
And then you panic.
Yeah, then you panic. Yeah. And then it just, mushrooms in there.
So the facilitator's number one job is to not panic, because if you are the ground control, and if you're panicking, then whatever is happening for the person that's under your care is you're just increasing their anxiety.
Yeah, yeah.
And so even in any situation, I mean, I've worked with a lot of research studies and a lot of research therapists, and sometimes they are concerned about what's going on, but it's really important that they are able to remain calm, you know, access the resources they have, and remain that stable anchor point for someone.
Did you ever panic on the inside and have to hold back the fear?
Me? During a psilocybin session? No.
Yeah, yeah.
But I've seen, I've had like calls from other therapists that I've been working with, therapists that I'm either training or supervising or things like that, where, they're telling me that, they were having a hard time and they were like worried about things. And it's okay if there's something going on that you're concerned about, but what you need to do is be able to still project that sense of calm and see someone through it.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Well, what would they report, or what would you see that would be along those lines? Someone having some anxiety, is that what you would hear?
Yeah, increased distress, increased anxiety. Sometimes therapists have not seen too many of these sessions, and so they may be, worried that something is wrong or something is awry. And you have to remember, in a research study, in a medical setting, I mean, they have every check and balance in place. There's a physician you can on call. There's, additional procedures for taking vital signs and things like that. You've always got emergency backup plans. And so you just need to know how to put those things in place without panicking. Mm-hmm.
So what sort of physical sensations would these individuals report?
So physical sensations, often it's like an intensification of bodily sensations. But also you have to remember that there's an altered state of consciousness going on and a altered sense of perception. So the body may feel especially, changing as though it's changing shape, or as though it's changing orientation or size, or as though it's not felt for moments of time. And again, these are experiences where perception is altered. And so that can be something that people are responding to. Whether they're responding to it with curiosity or panic is really the line that they're walking.
Or euphoria as well?
Euphoria, for sure.
Yeah. What would people be doing? Is the expectation that the customer can talk about whatever they want to or not talk about whatever they don't want to, and the facilitator is listening and reflecting and not directing, and is that the expectation?
Yeah, and I think, again, in Oregon, you've got more flexibility in terms of what someone is able to do or what they're going to engage with during that session. Many research studies, are really encouraging people to focus on their internal experience. But, if someone had just a different preference for where they wanted to focus, because it's not treatment, it's not a treatment protocol, they would have a little more flexibility under the adult supervised use model.
So the things that I'll hear from people as they do these kinds of things recreationally or even in these treatment protocol methods, potentially, not everyone, of course, but a sense of well-being, a sense of potential euphoria, a sense of self-discovery, a sense of putting a lot of things in perspective, like death and dying, for example, which is one of the tested, issues that's being tested on right now, which people will say, I become one with the cosmos or the universe. No joke. I felt like I understood how big and gigantic the universe was, and I felt connected to the universe. I felt connected to other people, and I could sort of feel my entire life in perspective. And I now have just a general wisdom or a general sense that whatever the universe has for me, whether it's I'm dying in 6 months or I don't, like I feel like I understand. I feel like I can accept what the universe is. I'm telling a particular version of this. You'll hear that sort of thing. You'll hear people say that they were contemplating a particular question, like should I get a divorce or something like this, and the session really helped them to further their understanding themselves or put it in perspective, like I said, or maybe even answer some questions. Am I still in love with this person? And I discovered that. Or they will report that after a number of administrations regarding trauma and PTSD, that even though they still remember the trauma, they have none of the symptoms. They no longer have the triggers. They no longer have the distress. They no longer have the avoidance. And their healing process might continue, but the sharp edges to their trauma have been rounded off, and it was life-saving to them. Whereas before they felt like every day was a struggle and every minute was a struggle, and afterwards it wasn't. Those are the things that I've heard from people personally and online. Is that all part of potential things? I don't want to force you into answering a question that you're just going to give me a diplomatic answer. So any comment on my reiteration of people's anecdotes?
It's all possible. It's all possible. And you have to forgive my diplomatic answers, but at the same time, I'm in a position where I'm very, very excited about what is possible and the kinds of things that people can achieve or can experience and then put into place in their lives through this kind of work. You call it, through as therapy or under adult supervised use. I think there's a lot of potential for benefit in both paradigms. At the same time, it's like neither one of these things is can make these can make promises right now. And we're just a little too early in the game for, you know, for giving like very specific treatment outcome promises or very specific outcome promises from the adult supervised use. In fact, it's not, can't be offered as treatment anyway. So my real hope is that people will stay open and hopeful and understand that whichever, you know, if they're looking for this, seeking it for themselves, whatever route they take or wherever they, you know, wherever they wind up, if they wind up at going to a research study or, you know, finding a facilitator to work with, in a supervised setting, that the individual possibility is really there. But the field just isn't mature enough to start kind of figuring out the details and, you know, making real predictions there.
So in the last couple of minutes, can I do a lightning round? Conservative backlash.
A lot of conservative politicians are actually really interested in psychedelic bills and supporting them. Bipartisan support. We've got a lot of veterans organizations are involved.
I wonder if that's why, because it involves veterans.
Vets, first responders. There's actually a lot of bipartisan support. Yeah.
Most annoying question you get at dinner parties.
Did you bring free samples?
Might it be accused, this bill in Oregon, as a workaround regarding moving forward with the treatment without proper medical oversight?
People have said that. I think it addresses a different set of issues.
If the ethics and the training is followed and all that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah.
You know, similar to, say, coaching, for example, you know. Other substances that might be involved in the future, we've mentioned MDMA, psilocybin, mm-hmm. both derived from mushrooms and from synthetic sources, but there's also LSD, ayahuasca, arguably cannabis could be involved. But I've also seen, I mean, so that all makes sense, ketamine. But I've also heard and read some people talking about PCP and salvia being used. Any thoughts on that?
I would say look out for research on 5-MeO-DMT and also look out for research on ibogaine.
Why? Because it's in the future? It's coming?
Those are both things that are both naturally occurring compounds that are sort of being brought into research settings in the early stages, I would say now. And we may have more interesting clinical research coming out in both of those areas.
So in these boutique spas, there might be a variety of options on the menu in the future, 10, 20 years from now or something.
It's possible. Yeah.
Microdosing, question mark.
Microdosing. Not a lot of research evidence. And certainly I wouldn't take it for granted that it's a safe thing to do because you're giving yourself repeated exposure to a small dose of something, usually for an ongoing period of time, where most of the research that we have and safety data is related to one or a few larger doses under a supervised setting. But it's still a phenomena that I think needs more research to be properly understood, but it doesn't have the level of research support that these larger dose or full dose psychedelic assisted therapy protocols have.
When people ask me, and people ask me a lot about psychedelic therapy, it's whenever I do a live Q&A, I would venture to say I always get asked. And one of the things that I will say, and I reference my education from you, one of the things that I say, and this isn't necessarily what you were saying, but this is what I'm saying, which is that it seems likely that in the future, it will be a tool that will be available to psychiatrists that might be very transformative, will likely be very transformative for a set of individuals that have a set of issues, and also their body or their mind just responds in a therapeutic way to this substance. And there will be many people where it won't benefit them, and many people where it might even be a net negative to their life. Similar to any other substance in the toolbox, Prozac, benzodiazepines, antipsychotics, whatever, you know, that it'll be something along those lines. Like when research about SSRIs first came out in the 70s and 80s, it was touted as the happy drug. It was touted as this universal substance that was going to change the entire landscape. And it certainly did change us as a field. But it's not this ubiquitous substance that everyone takes to make their to enhance their life. And especially as more time goes on, we gather more data, the effect size gets smaller and smaller over time, you know, because that's just the nature of these kinds of data over time processes. And so I will say it seems likely that it'll be useful, but the hype around it is overblown. You know, people will claim, not responsible researchers, but, you know, many people will claim like this is complete, essentially reporting that this will eliminate PTSD from the human population. This will eliminate depression from the human population. This will eliminate lack of well-being from the, you know, they say that directly, but it seems like that's the implication.
It's not going to alleviate the human condition. You know, it's, I think it could be an important tool and an important piece of what we can do for in terms of helping people. I think it offers an important paradigm shift in terms of how we think about mental health and how we think about suffering and distress and how we think about the patient's role in this process. Because one thing we haven't talked much about is what an active and engaged role people who are going through this kind of treatment or therapy have. It's really very much, you know, it's really very much supportive of their autonomy and them developing their own insights and those sorts of things, which is contrary to a lot of traditional therapeutic approaches where the therapist is the expert, the psychiatrist is the expert. But this isn't going to, you know, wipe away all human suffering. We have a lot of work to do as a society. We have a lot of work to do as a culture. I do think there are some larger implications that make this important in terms of how we think about drugs and drug policy and those sorts of things. But it needs to be used responsibly, and it's not going to be for everyone. Not everyone will be able to physically or mentally, emotionally tolerate taking a psychedelic. And that's okay. There should be alternatives. I think a lot of the techniques and things that we're learning and ways of interacting that we're developing in these therapies can also be used with non-drug, non-ordinary states of consciousness. And that those can be an accessible alternative for people with health concerns, people with heart concerns, or people for whom they're just not ready to actually ingest a psychedelic compound. So a lot of options, a lot of work to be done, but we really need to be cautious about overstating the, you know, with the hype here or creating more hype. It's definitely a long path of responsible use that we've got ahead of us.
Did people who got placebo in your experience have the same amount of benefit potentially? I mean, obviously not as much if you're, well, who knows what the data would say, but did people who take placebo report discoveries? Because, you know, you just imagine there's this several hours while two people who are intently listening to you. Did that ever happen?
You know, anecdotally, yeah, some people reported some insights. I think it's not uncommon if people are sort of focusing on their internal experience and they're in this kind of meditative state for a day. Most of the studies that I worked on were like a psychotherapy protocol plus the psychedelic sessions. So they were getting that anyway. So it was like a psychotherapy only or psychotherapy plus psychedelic condition. And so overall, people would tend to benefit. But I also think that, you know, for certain populations, the feeling of disappointment around thinking that they got a placebo can be really profound. And that's something that, you know, that we need to take into account, and it should be limited in terms of how much of that is done, because it can just be really disheartening for people if they've put a lot of work in. And so what I've seen is programs of research be designed where people who got placebo in a double blind trial, you know, after all the results are in and the database is locked and everything is set with that trial, the sponsors can go through and actually invite the people that got placebo back for another open label study where they will get the active psychedelic. And that, you know, it's just a way of, I think, extending that that offer, that we feel that there is enough reason to believe that this could be beneficial, that we want to offer that to people as an option.
Yeah. about a couple hours in, the individual's like, ah, shit, I'm in the placebo group. God damn it. You know, I've been looking forward to this, or I've been doing all these other prep things. I've signed all the forms and, ah. But then you work it in like, well, you could come back. And they're like, oh, okay, well, later time. So to close, you're a director at Fluence. So people can go to fluence.org or .com.
It's fluencetraining.com. So I'm the co-founder of Fluence. We started it in 2019 after a series of psychedelic harm reduction and integration workshops for clinicians. We have training programs in psychedelic harm reduction and integration. We have training programs in ketamine-assisted psychotherapy and psilocybin facilitators training program for people that want to work in Oregon under that new license.
Okay. Well, great. Well, thanks for coming back. I didn't know about this thing in Oregon. I mean, I'd heard a little bit about it, but I didn't know how extensive it was. So there was a lot to report on in terms of the new developments in our field. This is the very beginning of the next phase of the change in our society, really, where people can actually participate in government-regulated experience with psychedelics. That's pretty amazing.
It is pretty amazing. I think all the leaders in the field, we kind of wake up every day like, is this really happening? Because it's happening. It seems like it's happening so fast. I mean, it's only been 2 years since this was just over 2 years since it was voted into measure was voted into being. And now it's happening in other states. FDA trials are starting and actually finishing. There are just major developments going on. So it's a lot to follow, but we really try to help our students keep up and stay up to date and get involved in this as a career.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for coming on the show, and everyone out there, take care of yourself. Dr. Nielsen, why should people take care of themselves?
Well, if you want to take care of someone else, you're going to have to take care of yourself first.